You never really know what's going down inside the house, next door, or down the block.
At that time, it was probably the biggest investigation that myself and Lieutenant Popchef had ever run across.
The people who lived on LaSalle Street in Indianapolis had no idea that the men who lived inside a modest home at 1318 had had their throats slashed. That is, until they saw the cops show up and ambulances and the coroner on December 1st, 1971.
Well, it was a very sensational case, and it was also very gruesome because of the nature of the way they were killed.
Hands, feet tied, gaping throat wound.
That day, 50 years ago, began a half-century fixation on the killer or killers, a search that would lead authorities to people with reasons, people who were more than capable of committing murder.
These three guys, they weren't real nice, upstanding citizens.
And the case would attract people who just wanted a piece of the action.
It is not probably one of the brightest moments in my life to have to dismiss a case like that.
And while the cops were trying to find out who killed the men, finding out why may have proven even more intriguing.
These three guys had had a contest to see which one of the three could sleep with the most women.
The story of James Barker, Robert Gearcy, and Robert Henson has become one of Indiana's most fascinating cases. The murderer or murderers are likely dead, but the fascination is very much alive. And even a half century later, you may still want to know who killed the men and why.
As a family on the east side of the city, cowering in fear.
Freelance writer Carol Schultz's meddling has made a conviction impossible.
Their boss also had an insurance policy, $100,000.
Much of the ability to corroborate that evidence was compromised.
You'll now go on a 50-year journey.
Film and book rights hinged on a conviction.
Murder times three on LaSalle Street. In this news special, you will hear something about the killings on LaSalle Street that you may not have heard or read many places, or may have never heard before. The neighborhood around LaSalle Street these days could be called anything but quiet. The area of 10th and Rural in Indianapolis has become known for violent crime, but the street itself is still relatively calm. The drive to the scene of the 50-year-old crime is serene at 10 in the morning. Two streets down, kids play at recess at a charter school called Paramount Brookside. Pulling to the side of the street, a man walks his dog in front of the infamous residence. And the only real change, according to photographs from the day after the murders, is a tree that now shades the house. 50 years ago, the events inside the house and in the lives of the men who lived there became a matter of public record and the talk of Indianapolis.
In my book, I have a picture of her.
That's the photograph.
Robert Snow is a former homicide captain with the Indianapolis Metro Police Department and has become an authority on the case. He also wrote a book about it called Slaughter on North LaSalle.
A friend of theirs named John Carnes had come over to see him, and he went to their business. They were running a microfilm business at that time called B&B Microfilming Service Incorporated, and he went there to see him, and the secretary there said, well, they haven't shown up today. Well, these guys were kind of hard partiers, and so she wasn't surprised. Sometimes they party hard and they'd come in, you know, a little late, and then work late until the evening to get their work done. And he knocked on the door, nobody answered, and he went around to the back. They did part of their work also in the back, in the garage behind the house. And he didn't, you know, nobody was there either, so, but the cars were there, so he went and tried the front door, and it was unlocked. And he went in, and he found the three men in the house.
Back to December 1st, 1971, and a report from WIBC News.
Three men were found murdered at the house at 1318 North LaSalle Street on the city's east side. Detective Pat Stark of the Indianapolis Police Department Homicide Branch began the investigation.
One subject laying on the bathroom floor on his back with his hands and feet tied with a huge gaping wound in his throat. One subject in the rear bedroom laying on his back, hands, feet tied, gaping throat wound. One subject in the front bedroom on his side and stomach, hands tied behind him and feet tied.
Police have cordoned off the area around the house in the 1300 block of North LaSalle. They have also blocked the street at that location while the crime lab and the detectives begin the investigation. No sure motive has yet been determined, but Stark said that the house was ransacked. Paul Page, WIBC News.
They are bound by hand and foot both, and they'd all be killed by a cut in the throat. Matter of fact, it was cut so severely that the coroner said just one or two more cuts, they'd have been beheaded.
Well, it was a very sensational case, and it was also very gruesome because of the nature of the way they were killed.
Tom Cochran, longtime Indianapolis newsman who worked for WIBC and Indianapolis TV as well.
This could have been a vendetta, revenge, or a professional hit.
They'd also all of them been hit in the back of the head several times.
You may have heard the theory that the attacker had a gun to force the men to cooperate. Captain Snow says that's not likely.
Most of them been hit several times in the back of the head. So the police theorize that somebody has snuck up behind them and hit them in the back of the head, that these men had come home individually, you know, separately, and each time would come in and somebody was hiding in the house and hit them in the back of the head, then bound them and cut their throats.
But why would someone kill Henson, Gearcy, and Barker? Police didn't know at first, but after a search of the house and some digging into the men's work and their extracurricular activities, some motivations began to become evident.
These three guys in the year 1971 had a contest to see which one of the three could sleep with the most women. And they kept a list in the house on LaSalle Street, the police found. It had 63 women's names on it that the three men had slept with.
They were seen as playboys, fellas who were oftentimes frequenting bars. In those days, they were called low bars or dives. Maybe they still are referred to as that. But these were places where the guys could go and find women that they could then add as a conquest. They also liked to fight. They were known as brawlers.
With 63 notches on the collective bedposts, that gave Indianapolis detectives a big list of people to talk to about the killings. It should also be noted that Gearcy and Henson lived in the house. Barker may have inadvertently come to the house to visit and been killed by the same person, just being in the wrong place at the wrong time.
So the problem with the case is the police had 63 women. Because what happened, if you're trying to sleep as many women as you can in a year, you sleep with any dumper. And, you know, that's not going to make your women feel real good about you. So the problem was the police had 63 suspects immediately, plus an untold number of ex-boyfriends and ex-husbands, or at the time, boyfriends and husbands.
And you may have heard Snow talk about microfilm. It's what the men did for work.
Speed and ease in managing the great volume of publications has been aided by using micrographics, the system of reducing information to microform.
From a film on microfilm made by Indiana University.
The micrographic process reduces full-size hard copy to one of two broad microform categories.
The process was more than 20 years old at the time, but like electronic storage now, was still lucrative because huge rooms worth of books and paper could be stored in much smaller areas on film, and it was also cost efficient.
Now, there's some interesting Ted Ulan, who had been their boss at Record Security, and also had an insurance policy, which is common then. They were two big executives working for him. He had an insurance policy, $100,000 on Gearcy and $50,000 on Henson, that was in the grace period at that time. It was very soon to expire. And, you know, that made him a suspect in 1970. I mean, $150,000, even today, is a lot of money. But 1971, that was a huge, huge amount of money.
That was one of the theories that Detective Jim Strode had investigated.
Tom Cochran, longtime Indianapolis journalist.
I thought Jim Strode was one of the best cops working in Indianapolis. He was a real smart fella. He had street smarts. He had a way of sort of reading human psychology, and he was an excellent investigator. He could look at a crime scene. He could look at the evidence and pieces of information and put it together. And Strode's early speculation was that it might be related to the theft of equipment and perhaps the stealing of money from a fellow that they had worked with down in southern Indiana.
Coming up.
Now, he come on barefoot, the wiper naturally wasn't what's going on. He said, I had to bring my boots.
Why, even the best police tech at the time wasn't enough. and
this case will be
a return to the crime a quarter of a century later.
Won or lost with witnesses.
You're listening to Murder Times 3 on LaSalle Street.
Well, it was a shocking crime, and it was enormous in its brutality, and because of that, it was very riveting, and it captured a lot of attention simply because of that.
December 1st, 1971. James Barker, Robert Gearcy, and Robert Henson were all found dead in separate rooms, throats cut nearly ear to ear, in a house on LaSalle Street in Indianapolis.
Well, it was probably the biggest investigation that myself and Lieutenant Popchef had ever run across.
Smart, well-trained, and studied detectives had been on the case, but the evidence didn't seem to be enough to even make an arrest, much less get a conviction.
That's what strikes me the most, was the amount of bodies and the amount of evidence and things that had to be done.
The men had, with respect to their souls, many reasons to be dead. Two of them had a sex contest going on to see who could sleep with the most women by year's end, racking up 63 notches between them.
They were young, middle-aged, single men. Two lived in the house on the south, and the third probably just happened to stop by and was a victim of circumstances. Wrong place at the wrong time.
And they had crossed their boss, a man in southern Indiana, Gibson County, named Ted Euland, who ran a lucrative microfilm business there.
Speculation was that it might be related to the theft of equipment and perhaps the stealing of money from a fellow that they had worked with down in southern Indiana.
Captain Robert Snow, retired IMPD detective and author of the book Slaughter on North LaSalle.
They had worked for a company, for a man named Ted Ewan at Record Security Company, and they had quit to start their own company. But when they left, they stole a bunch of their former boss's money, a bunch of his equipment, and they were doing a bang-up job enough that they were stealing all of his customers.
And with microfilm still being something of a fascinating technology at the time and lucrative, some people theorized, or at least it was published in some newspaper articles, that the mafia may have been involved in the murder, a theory that Snow believes had little credence.
There was a speculation that came along later that it might have had something to do with the fact these guys were in the microfilm business.
Journalist Tom Cochran.
And there were some kind of secrets or trade secrets or espionage involved. I don't think that theory had a lot of plausibility, but it certainly got an airing at a particular time.
But detectives were piling on the man hours, taking phone calls, re-examining forensic evidence, and checking out each tip that came in.
My standard answer is maybe hundreds and thousands. I never really kept track of them. I know quite a few days and nights and weeks and months, and anytime we ever heard of anything, you know, even after that, years after that, we always run it down.
As yet, no clues have been uncovered as to the identity of the murderer or the murderers of three Indianapolis men, two of them operators of the B&B Microfilm Service Company, 4446 East 10th Street, whose mutilated bodies were found bludgeoned and their throat slashed in their residence at 1318 North LaSalle Street. But apparently someone who may have connections with the case has a family on the east side of the city cowering in fear.
From a report not long after the murders on WIBC with Bob Hoover.
A telephone call to the home was answered with the mother, and speaking gruffly, a man's voice said, anybody in connection with, and we delete the girl's name, is in danger.
They got thousands of tips.
Turns out, as intriguing a story as it was, it ended up having nothing to do with the LaSalle Street killings and was an example of one of the thousands of tips investigated.
Everybody thought they knew who did this thing, but it never, none of that. So this was this case, and most of, almost all the tips, none of them panned out.
It was a gruesome case, and it was in the headlines. It was on the radio and television daily for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then, of course, there was always the return to it because it was an unsolved case and it was such a sensational case.
But that was no indication that the murders would be solved. And the weeks went by, and they became months. And life went on in Indianapolis, and the murders on LaSalle Street eventually faded. later, you'll learn just to what extent.
Anytime you have a big case like this that goes cold, it bugs the tar out of you. But there were just simply too many suspects and no real evidence.
But in a photograph taken outside of the house by an Indy Star photographer on the day that the bodies of Giersey, Henson, and Barker were discovered, stands a woman crying. Unknown to the photographer at the time, that woman's husband would show back up in a major way for detectives 20 years after the murders.
He did surface early on in the investigation, but never really came to light as a serious suspect back at that time.
And a small detail from outside the house, relayed to police by a neighbor, would also lead police to a conclusion even years after that.
That night they saw a yellow car parked there. So they reported a yellow car parked in front of the door that had Gibson County plates. Interesting enough, Mr. Ewan lived in Gibson County, but he had a rock solid alibi. They checked out. He was there the whole time. But just, you know, nobody seemed to pay much attention to that in the original investigation. I mean, they made a note of it, but nobody really followed through real heavy on that.
You might wonder, with all of the evidence that's collected at a crime scene, especially one as bloody as the LaSalle Street murders, why a basic tool like fingerprints couldn't be used to find the killer. And quickly.
That was before AFIS, the Automated Fingerprint Identification System, which is a computer-driven system that can match them, you know, to match up to millions of prints, you know, within a few minutes and tell you who it is.
Retired homicide captain Robert Snow.
Now, before that, you really couldn't do anything. If you had a print and didn't have anybody to match again, you couldn't, because everybody's got 10 prints. You got one print, and we got maybe, you know, 100,000 prints on file, so you got a million prints. There's no way you could sort through them. But now with AFIS, it just takes a few minutes.
How did they do it back then? Was it by the type of print?
No, you had to have a suspect.
Gotcha.
Yeah, you had. Now, if you had a suspect, they just take his prints and whoop, yep, you're in.
And at the time, forensic crime scene science was still about 15 years away from being able to collect and analyze DNA evidence.
And even then, DNA wasn't that good. It took a while to really perfect it, where now you can do from one skin cell. They can do DNA from one skin cell. Or in those days, I remember there was another case that we had where they found a drop of blood about the size maybe a millimeter wide. But that time, they said you had at least a size of a quarter. And this detective held that case until the DNA got far enough it could do it on that and finally brought the person to trial and convicted him.
Computers have certainly sped up the process, and advances in DNA technology have made it easier to find killers using their genetic code. But old-fashioned police know-how also played a part in what detectives did at the time to screen out the phonies, and later to perhaps be determinant about the person police believe may have done it.
When you have a murder like this, a murder that's very newsworthy, and you never release all the facts, you keep a couple of them secret, because cases like this will bring people out of the woodwork who want to confess to it. I mean, even though you're looking at death penalty or maybe life sentence, there are a lot of people who simply want to confess to this kind of thing because they think it makes them famous and, you know, you'll be a name known by everyone. Some people can accumulate a lot of evidence from newspapers and all, you know, the radio program, television and everything to act like they know what's going on there. But you always leave out one or two pieces, and if they don't know about those, they're not the killer.
And on December 1st, 1971, there was a piece of evidence collected on the floor of the house on LaSalle Street that throughout all of the publicity and the years of speculation, no one knew about except the police.
In this case, there was a bloody boot print in the living room, and also a cigar stub in the ashtray. Now, unfortunately, this is before DNA. That meant nothing. I mean, the boot print, unless you could find a pair of boots, if you knew a suspect and could find a pair of boots, that really wasn't any valued.
And at the time, there was no pair of boots with which to match the print found in the living room. But Luke 8:17 says, "For all that is secret will eventually be brought into the open, and everything that is concealed will be brought to light and made known to all." And sometimes time has a way of bringing out those dirty secrets.
The man accused of the notorious LaSalle Street murders bonded out of jail Monday.
Coming up, a reason to look at the case again 25 years later.
Some of the more wild theories really probably came on a recircling of trying to figure out what happened in this case.
And why the big yellow car may have been a relevant clue that detectives should have questioned harder. You're listening to Murder Times 3 on LaSalle Street.
In December of that year, three men, James Baker, Robert Gearsey, and Robert Hinson, were found with their throats cut.
The case was cold as ice in 1991, until a freelance journalist named Carol Schultz decided that she would be the one to solve the LaSalle Street murders. You're listening to Murder Times 3 on LaSalle Street.
My opinion is that he may have been involved.
You're hearing Mary Duke, daughter of a man named Carol Horton, whose wife was one of the people seen grieving outside the house on LaSalle Street on the day of the murders of Hinson, Gearsey, and Barker. Her photo was published in the Indianapolis Star.
So you think you know, you think you, your dad know who, knows who did it, but...
Oh, what he knew who did it.
He knew who he did it, but he didn't talk.
No, he didn't.
Mary Duke is being interviewed on the Lamont at Large video cast on YouTube at her father's grave.
Well, now, what year was he arrested?
1996.
He was arrested in 1996, and so he was all over the newspapers here in Indianapolis. And
yeah.
The detectives, they think they had got their man. Why did they arrest him?
Because a reporter and a jail informant had came up with a story and told the prosecutors and Sheriff Layton, and he proceeded to indict my dad.
Let's rewind just a minute. Who were Diane and Carol Horton?
Diane Horton was a girlfriend at that time of Bob Gearsey.
Retired Indianapolis Police Homicide Captain Robert Snow, author of the book Slaughter on North LaSalle.
Her husband was Carol Horton. And the police, for a while, when this case started in 1971 and was resurrected in 1991. And in 1991, the police... suspected it might have been Carol Horton. Her ex-husband might have had something to do with it.
Was he a suspect at the beginning?
Yeah, but a fringe suspect type thing.
To understand how Carol Horton's name began to be uttered again by detectives 20 years after the 1971 murders, you probably should know about Carol Schultz and why she wanted to solve the LaSalle Street murders. Schultz was not truly a full-time correspondent with the Indianapolis News, although some news outlets have credited her as such. She was freelance, paid by the story, and most of her stories were features involving home and garden subject matter, according to an interview that she gave the Indianapolis Monthly. When Unsolved Mysteries planned a taping in Indy, Schultz was assigned to write a feature about it and remembered her dad talking to her about the LaSalle Street murders when she was a little girl. She began research and found herself intrigued by the sex contest and admittedly attracted to the victims.
For some reason, she picked up an interest in the case and started investigating. And her first suspect, she thought, was Carol Horton. And so she started just nosing around to find what she could find. And somehow, Carol Horton put her onto a gentleman named Floyd Chastain, who at that time was serving a big sentence in Florida. For murder in Florida. And anyway, so she would question Carol, and he would feed her little bits of information.
Floyd Chastain eventually admitted to having a part in the murders, but put the finger on Horton from his Florida prison cell. That eventually led to an indictment.
69-year-old Carol Horton entered the courtroom in prison fatigues and used a crutch. His attorney, John Smart, says Horton has leg and heart problems.
He's a 69-year-old gentleman. He's got a rough way to go.
Horton is accused of slitting the throats of three men on LaSalle Street in December of 1971. Some evidence in the case was accidentally thrown away in 1986, but Ralph Staples of the prosecutor's office says that won't hurt the 25-year-old murder case.
The vast majority of the evidence that was lost doesn't relate directly to this defendant. A lot of it was just the stuff that was taken out of the house when the police were investigating.
Horton maintains his innocence, saying there's a police cover-up. His trial date set for June 10th. John Bartholomew, WIBC News.
You just heard a revelation that some of the evidence was lost, something Captain Snow says should never happen and almost never does.
You never destroy evidence. We've got homicide cases down at the police department. We did when I was there back to the 1920s. Now you know anybody who did that's dead. Probably is dead by now. But we just don't throw them away. We keep it and keep all the evidence. It sure makes cold cases much easier to solve.
Ralph Staples at the Marion County Prosecutor's Office was asked about the difficulty in the case because some evidence was thrown out some years back. But Staples says that evidence doesn't matter.
This case will be won or lost with witnesses.
Horton's trial date was set for June the 10th with a pretrial hearing May 31st.
Yeah, while Carroll Harden was a familiar name, he did surface early on in the investigation, but never really came to light as a serious suspect back at that time.
But in 1996, he was indicted and was scheduled to go on trial for murder based on circumstantial evidence gathered by Indianapolis detectives who had been working on the case with information from Carol Schultz since 1991.
An indictment is not a conviction, but again, I think it's a credit to the detectives and to all the people who spent so many years of frustration and hard work and didn't get a whole lot of credit for it to finally know that someone cared enough to hear the case and make some kind of a decision. And I think that's all the detective ever asked, is that this case be heard.
But as the trial date neared and Horton and his lawyers prepared to face the charges, the case against Carol Horton began to fall apart, largely the fault of the person who had started the renewed investigation, freelance journalist Carol Schultz. She admitted in her interview with the Indianapolis Monthly that her over-the-phone relationship with Floyd Chastain may have crossed an ethical line. She says she told him, "I love you," at one point, but she was not leading him on, that she was expressing Christian love. Chastain, though, may have felt differently. When Schultz took her information to police, she was actually crossing a line then, though she defended her actions, saying she felt responsible as a citizen. The most damning information, though, was when she testified at a pretrial hearing that she had signed a movie deal potentially worth $150,000 based on her investigation, if there was a conviction. And Floyd Chastain, a convicted murderer, proved untrustworthy when he admitted to having told at least five versions of the story of the LaSalle Street murders.
The man accused of the notorious LaSalle Street murders bonded out of jail Monday, and with the prosecutor's consent, he won't be returning to court. Marion County Prosecutor Scott Newman, following a judge's scathing comments about the lack of credibility among witnesses, has dismissed charges against Horton and convicted murderer Floyd Chastain.
It is not probably one of the brightest moments in my life to have to dismiss a case like that, but I feel absolutely that it's the right thing to do.
Newman says witnesses withheld important information from the grand jury that indicted Horton. Ex-freelance writer Carol Schultz said she had no financial stake in the case, while film and book rights hinged on a conviction. And a 25-year-old box of evidence found in a detective shed over the weekend shed some light unfavorable to the state's case. Gene Shannon, WIBC News.
And another report from 1996.
In a clipped voice, prosecutor Scott Newman told reporters Carol Horton is off the hook. Horton bonded out of jail Monday, not knowing the charges would be dismissed hours later. Newman says freelance writer Carol Schultz's meddling has made a conviction impossible.
Much of the ability to corroborate that evidence was compromised or even fabricated by the transmittal of confidential case-related information to Carol Schultz, and from there to Floyd Chastain.
Chastain was a key witness against Horton. Schultz also failed to tell the grand jury she stood to gain from film and book rights even more with a conviction. Newman says dropping charges against Horton and Chastain is not the highlight of his life, but it's the right thing to do. Gene Shannon, WIBC News.
With charges dropped and Horton free, the LaSalle Street murders were once again a cold case and would remain that way for another 4 years. But for Mary Duke, Carol Horton's daughter, her own experience with her dad's anger issues leaves her believing that just because there was no conviction or even a trial, that his chastity in the matter may still be in question, as she tells Lamont at Large.
He accidentally bumped into a telephone pole in an alley.
While he was driving?
Yes. Very slow. Wasn't a big deal. But
and somebody had laughed at him.
Yeah, and called him stupid mother.
Okay. So when he jumped out, he
proceeded to beat him with his cane.
He beat the guy with his cane.
Yeah.
Bad.
Pretty bad.
Would you be surprised if your dad actually did it?
No.
Though Horton had a long rap sheet and served time for theft, it appeared, at least according to the legal system, that murder was not part of his resume. So who committed murder times three on December 1st, 1971, ending a contest of conquest and the lives of two playboys and an unwitting buddy?
It's like anything. Follow the money.
Indy's former homicide captain says he knows and is quite stalwart in his belief.
The police suspected him.
Coming up.
And wanted him to take a lie detector test. He kept promising he would and promising he would, but he never did. He never did take
it. An exploration of the scenario that may be the one and that may explain the LaSalle Street murders.
He always carried a couple of knives with him.
You're listening to Murder Times 3 on LaSalle Street.
We've been working on the latest lead and the latest information for the past several years, or the past 4 or 5 years, yeah.
In 1996, Carol Horton was arrested and charged with committing the 1971 LaSalle Street murders in Indianapolis.
Okay, is Mr. Horton a focus of that over the past 4 or 5 years?
The information we received some 4 or 5 years ago is what eventually led to his arrest.
He was also let go before trial. Charges dismissed because of the meddling of a former freelance journalist.
Much of the ability to corroborate that evidence was compromised or even fabricated by the transmittal of confidential case-related information to Carol Schultz and from there to Floyd Chastain.
That left the case cold for another 4 years.
November 17th, in the year 2000, we got a letter at the police department from a lady named Angel Palma, who lived down in Jasper, Indiana, down in Gibson County.
Retired Indianapolis homicide captain Robert Snow says he believes the case was solved with the discovery of a letter by the family of a man from Gibson County, a man who was missing a pair of boots.
And she basically said that her dad, Fred Robert Harbison, had died. And they cleared out a safe deposit box. They found actually two letters in there. One was addressed to the police department. One was addressed to Indianapolis Star.
You're listening to Murder Times 3 on LaSalle Street.
And he basically said that he had been hired by Ted Ewan, the previous employer of two of the men, and the one who had the $150,000 policy on, to kill them. And he had done it, but then he wouldn't pay him. He kept saying the money was held up, the money's held up type thing. And that's why he put the letter in the safe deposit box.
But what would lead Captain Snow to believe, after nearly 30 years and the botched prosecution of Carol Horton, that Fred Harbison was telling the truth in his letters?
He also said in the letter that he had left a bloody footprint in the house. He knew he had, so when he got back home down in Jasper, he buried his boots. And Roy went down and talked to the wife. She says, yeah, I remember him coming home and said, he wouldn't tell me why, but he had to bury the boots.
You might remember Snow talking about police procedure and how they hold back pieces of evidence from getting into the news. The bloody boot print and the cigar in the ashtray were two parts that were not in the newspapers, radio, or TV news at the time.
See, nobody knew about the blade footprint. That was one of those things we kept back, but he did know about it. And also, he smoked cigars, by the way.
Another piece of evidence that was documented, but with little follow-up in 71, was a big, long, yellow car with a Gibson County tag seen parked outside the house. Snow says that also fits into the scenario.
In the letter, he says that the police said there was a yellow car in front of his house with the 26 places. Yeah, it was my yellow Roadrunner. That's what he did. Again, Roy went down there and checked and found out, yes, he did have a yellow Roadrunner at that time.
And the motive? Mostly money, according to Snow.
It's like anything. Follow the money. Okay, who had the most? Who would gain most from the three guys? Now, actually, we think that they were only targeting two, and that Jane Barker just showed up, because these three hung together real close. They were just three real close friends, and he just showed up at the house, spontaneously, and they had to kill him too.
You may remember that Ted Ewland was a former boss to Gearcy and Henson, and when they left his company, he had a life insurance policy out on the two men, worth a total of $150,000. When they left Record Security, Ewland's microfilm business, they also stole equipment and eventually clients, bringing them to their business in Indianapolis, which they worked on 10th Street and in their garage at home. Snow says police kept after Ewland, who had a solid alibi, to take a polygraph test. He promised he would, but never did. and other kinds of evidence seem right to Snow.
Besides having her throats cut, and everyone who knew Fred Harbison said, yep, he'd do it. That's the man. If anybody did it, he'd do it. And his wife said he was always, when he watched TV or anything, sharpening knives, always sharpening knives. And he always carried a couple of knives with him. And interesting enough, but more than that, these guys, the Nazis, these guys were tied up with, weren't just granny knots or whatever. There were some kind of special knots. And they had a person who knew about knots. And he talked to my wife, said, yeah, he was a specialist. He always wanted to show off the different kind of knots he would tie.
One subject laying on the bathroom floor on his back with his hands and feet tied with a huge gaping wound in his throat. One subject in the rear bedroom laying on his back, hands, feet tied, gaping throat wound. One subject in the front bedroom on his side and stomach, hands tied behind him and feet tied.
Now, the police could find no forced entry at the house, but Ted Ewan had a key to the house. Now, again, because when they first moved there, they were working for Ted Ewan, and they keep the products in their house. So apparently, Ted Ewan had a key so he could get in and get the products typed up. But he had a key. You wouldn't be somebody invited in, because then you couldn't get behind you to hit you in the back of the head. If a person comes to the front door and they let him in, how are they going to get behind him and hit him?
And that's how one person could get the job done without all three people rushing it.
All three of these guys were hitting the back of the head. So the police theorized that, somebody used the key, get in the house, and just waited for each one to come home. Because apparently they come home separately. They come home different times.
Snow says police took their findings, along with the letters, to the prosecutors.
We submitted this evidence to the prosecutor, and they officially closed the case. They thought it was enough.
So if the case is no longer a cold case and has been solved, you might wonder how come you haven't heard that before. And where was the fanfare when the prosecutor said it's over and done?
People say, well, why didn't I hear about it? This case had embarrassed the police officer, embarrassed the police department twice, embarrassed them because in 1971, they kept promising, yes, we'll have it solved, we'll make arrests by next week, and we'll do this, and it kept dragging on and on, and nothing happened.
A grand jury convened last year. They evaluated some evidence in the December 1st, 1971 murders.
Snow says the attempted prosecution of Carol Horton, gone faulty in 1996, was an embarrassment all around for the police and Marion County Prosecutor Scott Newman.
So we took this information up to the chief, and the chief of police said, good, we ain't, that's it. Put it away, it's solved, we're done. We're not making any kind of press releases on this. I mean, twice burnt, you're kind of shy about doing that. And that's why nothing ever came out about it. Somebody, the police department didn't want to commit themselves the third time to a case that embarrassed them twice.
I had sort of written that off as one of those crimes that would probably remain unsolved, and everybody who was involved would simply go to their graves knowing the truth, and none of the rest of us would.
Captain Snow says lessons can be learned from the LaSalle Street murders. One is that these crimes, many times, aren't solved quickly.
At every trial where there's any kind of evidence, scientific evidence, the prosecutor has to give the jury to tell them about the CSI effect. People see this on TV, there's some kind of technology, and they, well, why don't you use that? Because there is no such thing. They made it up for TV. Many murder cases take weeks and months sometimes to solve, and sometimes, in this case, years.
Another is never throw away evidence in a murder case.
The fact that it remained a brutal and unsolved crime meant that it just continued to get an awful lot of press coverage broadcast and in the newspaper as well.
And so it does 50 years later. Murder Times 3 on North LaSalle Street, written and produced by Chris Davis.